Welcome to the intersection of technology, cybersecurity, and society. Welcome to ITSP Magazine. Thank you for joining us for this conversation. BugCrowd's award-winning platform combines actionable contextual intelligence with the skill and experience of the world's most elite hackers to help leading organizations identify and fix vulnerabilities, protect customers, and make the digitally connected world a safer place. Learn more at bugcrowd.com. Devo unlocks the full value of machine data for the world's most instrumented enterprises. The Devo Data Analytics Platform addresses the explosion in volume of machine data and the crushing demands of algorithms and automation. Learn more at devo.com.
Let's go.
Let's go, Marco. Yes.
Let's do it.
It's number funny two. Seeing you on the screen. Here. Look at that. You're
number
not just a figure in a book.
No. I'm the real deal. And I'm feeling elevated. Are you?
I'm feeling elevated. I see what you're doing there. We are in the midst of the new series that we're working on in the Academy with our good friends from Elevate the Future, hailing from San Diego. And this is part of our Academy channel, where we look at how we as a society are learning and experiencing life and leveraging tech and understanding it, hopefully to make lives better. And different folks learn that in different ways, right? So some people listen to podcasts, others read books, others watch videos, others get their hands into the mix of things.
And talking about hands into the mix of things and breaking stuff and having fun while we learn, which I think that's kind of come out from our first conversation when we talked about this gap and how Elevate the Future was inspired to become a reality. We are now bringing a guest, which is coming from the San Diego area as well, I believe. I don't know where you are right now, but I know that's where you usually are.
We met you in San Diego anyway.
Yeah.
Yeah. I did anyway.
Yep.
And it's our friend Ted Harrington from the IoT Village, and he's going to help us to have this conversation with Nicole, Helen, and Sanvi from Elevate the Future. So why don't we start with Ellen? Give us a little introduction about who are the guests that you brought with you today, and then we'll pass the ball to Ted and we'll start the conversation.
Yeah, so here with me are Nicole and Sanvi. Nicole is the Director of Communications for Elevate the Future SD, and Sanvi is the Director of Operations. So really excited to have them with me today to talk about this.
Very, very cool. Nicole, how about a couple of words from you? Why are you with Elevate the Future? Let's start with that.
Okay. Well, in the beginning, Ellen kind of reached out to me when she was starting the chapter, and immediately I was just like kind of wowed by like the mission and then how like they plan to bring like computer science and business curriculum to like younger students, because that's something like even in our middle school, like we didn't really have a lot of areas that we could explore. So I was immediately like super interested, and I just like was so excited to help out and like manage the media and like manage the communications.
Great.
Sunday.
Oh, okay. So Ellen reached out to me as well. And as soon as I heard about it, I was like thrilled and excited to join the cause, because I always felt like I always wanted a platform in which I could make an impact, and Elevate the Future was like a perfect way to do so. So yeah.
That's wonderful. When we wrote a little introduction to the first episode, the first thing that I wanted to write was that you guys are in the middle of being educated and you're already thinking about educating the next generation. And it makes me feel really bad, because I feel like maybe our generation is the one that has been failing you. And you need to do that. And we have created this gap in cybersecurity, in the knowledge for technology and so forth. So Ted, a little introduction for those that don't know who you are. And I don't know, your thought on it already. How do we learn nowadays?
Sure. Yeah, so my name's Ted Harrington. I'm the author of a book called Hackable, How to Do Application Security Right. I'm one of the partners of a security consulting company. We're basically a bunch of ethical hackers, and we help companies find their vulnerabilities and fix them. And then what Marco was referring to is IoT Village, which is a really a community event where we bring researchers and academics and members of the government together to basically hack some IoT devices, but with the purpose of really trying to understand the issues, highlight the issues, help educate and train future generations of security researchers, and then ultimately drive change. So we've had to certainly adapt in the new world order to how do we do something that was designed from the beginning to be experiential and to be about in-person interaction. How do you take that into an online, sort of remote format? And it's going pretty well so far. I mean, we've done it twice now. We just, last week or a couple weeks ago, we ran it with DEF CON, totally virtually, totally online. And it was awesome. And we got to interact with these people from all over the world. I forget what the exact count was, but it was like dozens and dozens and dozens of countries were represented. So I think that even things like networking and hands-on activities can morph into this more online mode. So it's possible.
Yeah, we're definitely dealing with environmental changes to learning, but we've always had generational differences in how we learn as well, and don't necessarily want to stay focused solely on the generational differences, but younger folks in general, their brains might work a little differently and absorb information differently. So Ellen, maybe if you could kind of lead this off, and I know this was a topic that you wanted to have early on in the conversation. This is kind of the second to the what you're teaching. It's how kids learn, right? How students learn. So maybe you share a little bit about your insight into this particular topic.
Yeah, so as an organization of kind of students taught by students for students, so as students ourselves, we kind of see what works and what doesn't work. We're still in school and everything, so we kind of want to implement these different techniques and even online to make students kind of want to learn and develop passions for what we are teaching. So we really want to make it so that they're not just learning the material that we're teaching them, but they want to continue to go out of their way to research and explore the fields that we're introducing to them. So whether it's cybersecurity, computer science, or anything else that we're teaching them, we really want them to take that and bring it further on their own. So I think today's students, they're really growing up in a technological society. And with all these things around them, like video games, social media, or like developing technology, it's really important that we have to make learning fun as well. So like all of these things that they are interested in, it's really important to make learning the same way. So make learning feel like a video game, or make learning feel like you're talking to others as if it's like a social media platform, or like a way to make learning more engaging and interactive. So these kids actually do feel the passion to learn, and they do want to actually learn about the things that we're teaching them. So I think what we're really trying to do here in Elevate the Future SD is to make it more like, less like a class or lecture, but more like a workshop or a hands-on experience where it's just they go in and they get to try something new. And afterwards, they feel a sense like that they have to continue and they have to explore more or find new ways to code or build new things. So I think that's really what we're trying to accomplish here. And we're trying to really find ways that students learn and ways that we can make our curriculum more interactive so that we make it easier for them to learn and make them more excited to learn about what we're teaching.
Yeah, and Nicole, I like your thoughts on this because Ellen used a couple words there that stuck out to me, passion and excitement. And those aren't the first things I typically think of when I'm thinking about school. how do you raise that and generate that energy?
Oh, yeah. So, I think Common Core, although it has like some downsides, I think one really great thing about it is like it kind of brought a lot of like activities to the picture, and it made it seem like we weren't just memorizing facts, but instead like we were trying to understand the concepts. So like, for example, in like our chemistry or like biology classes, we'd always have labs and like activities. So we'd be like super hands-on with what we were learning, and we'd be able to do the activity rather than just like knowing the steps of how to do it. So then that was one thing that like kind of made class like seem like a game, like kind of like an event, and like Ellen said, like kind of like a video game, like we could pass levels kind of, and then have the final lab result, and it'd be super fun. And then just like another thing that kind of like virtual learning could help with like generating passion is that like students can implement their own learning style. Because I know that like in school and like which is in person, a lot of like kinesthetic learners or like auditory learners, they're kind of like not really able to like use their learning style to their advantage. But then like in virtual learning, we can like have more freedom to kind of learn the way that we want to. And then that also makes learning more fun. And then just like another thing, like our homework and our assignments. Like I remember when I was like in elementary school and then for like the spelling bees or like those spelling tests, like it was just memorization of like the letters and the orders and stuff. But then I think like now with like in high school, it's not memorization, like I said, it's more like active recall. We're like not just taking notes, we're also like doing other activities. We're applying it to our day-to-day lives. And then we have like a lot of more like just much more resources that we can use to like help ourselves and you know, learn the way that we like find efficient.
Yeah, I feel like this is like an experiment. You're and to be honest, school should be an ongoing experiment. We can't just settle on something because technology evolves, society evolves. What we thought was history 10 years ago, we kind of even changed that. So even in the humanistic things, stuff are changing. So this is a question for Sanvi, and then we can pass it to Ted, because Ted talked about, you know, moving online, and that was a necessity for the conference. And Sanvi, you guys deal with people from all over the world. So the online teaching is really important for you. And how do you keep engaged everyone? You know, what is that make them come back and want to learn more and know more? And then with that, I think Ted can jump in because it's the same deal with the village as well. So go ahead, Sanvi, let us know. What do you think?
Yeah, so we try to like implement like the same thing that happens in school, like the same hands-on learning and active recall into our curriculum. How we implement the active recall is that we have Kahoots or online quizzes at the end of our classes so that the students can recall what they learned in the lessons. We also have activities in the breakout rooms in which help them like reinforce the concepts that they just learned. A little bit more about like the learning by doing aspect of it. We put like the homework portion that is given in school or in part of the class, like we give them homework in the middle and then they have to complete it towards the end. We also have them code themselves using REPL. So they're going to be making their own code, not just looking at a screen and looking at someone else's code. And lastly, in our business classes, we had them actually make their own business plan. So that was good. And we actually had a mock Shark Tank in which they would like compete and like pitch their own products. So that was very collaborative and it was very effective in teaching the business concepts. We also implement collaboration or asking questions in our curriculum as well. For example, in order to keep everyone engaged in the breakout rooms, we make sure to like, you know, kind of catch them in the moment and like ask them questions about the concepts we just taught. It does like put them like on the spot, but it also is very effective in keeping them engaged, which is really important. So yeah.
Sounds fun.
Yeah, some of the things that we've implemented echo the themes that all three of you have talked about already, notably around how do you gamify the educational experience. And one of the things that is really the centerpiece in so many ways of what we do at IoT Village is having contests. And so one of those contests is called Capture the Flag. And that's essentially where we essentially take certain devices, we set them up to be vulnerable, and then students are encouraged to go, you know, find those vulnerabilities. And the reason that it's a really powerful educational technique is that you have to actually research how to do these things. And all the information is available either on our website or on other websites. And so what's really interesting is to see the participants go through the reconnaissance phase first and try to say, okay, well, what do I need to do in order to, you know, whatever the series of steps are, how do I, what needs to happen in order to achieve that? And then of course, you know, they're getting points for it and there's a leaderboard. So it's all the things that's fun about competition wrapped around this learning module. But I'm really interested in one element that I think is really, really different between what I'm doing and what you guys are doing. And I'd be curious to hear how you handle the concept of motivation. So when it comes to the people who participate in what we're doing, they are almost exclusively no longer students in the academic sense. They're life students for sure, but they're not necessarily, many of them are not in degree granting programs anymore. Some of them are, but for the most part, they're already professionals. So that kind of person who's going to take their own time to participate in something like this, they're kind of already wired that they want to learn in this way. They have the benefit of sort of wisdom of age to say, hey, no one else is going to make me learn. It's on me to learn. But I think we've all noticed, and probably all of us, well, I shouldn't speak for you, Sean and Marco, but maybe we've all experienced when we were students, it was more like someone had to force us to learn because it was just, we hadn't yet figured out yet that learning is good for us. So since the three of you are running this organization to help students learn more, and most students aren't already aware that it's incumbent upon them to, you know, build their own skills long-term, how do you deal with that? How do you get kids? The three of you are clearly motivated and driven yourself. So there's no question for you, but how do you get everyone else interested in doing something like this?
Yeah, I could start off with this, I guess. And Nicole and Swami can probably jump in too, but I think that's one of the things that we are really trying to work on. I think motivation, in the internal motivation in the students themselves versus some external motivation, for example, like their parents pushing them. I think that's really important that we try and really develop and induce that kind of internal motivation and really make them want to learn. So I think the main thing that we've been doing is, like, as you mentioned, we're trying to gamify everything and we're trying to make it so that each student gets to learn what they want to learn about. So we make sure that it's both the topics that we choose. So we make sure that the topics that we choose, so like computer science, cybersecurity, that the students actually feel interested to learn these things. And on top of that, also the method in which we deliver the information to the students. So if it's like an activity where they actually get to build their own website or make their own Python code, we really want to make it as interactive as possible and really make it feel like they're doing something and they get to actually use their knowledge and their experiences that they learned throughout the class to create something that they can use or they can show other people or benefit others. So I think students do really want to be able to create things. And I think that sort of like gratification of being able to make something is what keeps them motivated and like makes them want to come back, since ultimately it's they're the ones that has to want to learn. So I think that's one of the main factors.
Yeah, like what Ellen said, we like do try to make it as interactive as possible. I remember when we first, our first class that we hosted was a Python web development class. And I just remember a lot of the kids in my breakout room, they were really like, you know, looking to like, you know, code a calculator or like we use like this turtle thing, and then like they could create like shapes and designs and patterns, and then at the end like they would go and like show their parents, and it was super cute and super fun. But then in order to do that, they first had to like, you know, learn the modifiers, like, you know, learn the if else statements, learn the loop statements. They had to learn all of that before they could get to the fun stuff. So that was like kind of a motivation for them, that like in order to, you know, like create this thing, they had to like learn the material first.
Yeah, so when students like really realize that they can apply their skills to make something tangible in the end, that's when they like make that connection that, hey, you know, like I should invest time in learning programming, or I should invest time in learning business because this will help me in the future. We had them make a business plan and we had them code, so they had that realization in the end that they can use these skills in the future to make something that is truly tangible and that they can apply to the real world. So yeah.
Yeah. Can I follow up with what you guys just said with a very admittedly self-serving question, for the best kind? So you mentioned this idea of students are motivated to build things, and I completely agree with that. In my field, which has a tremendous shortage of talent, what we do is we break things that others have built. And one of the things that is the bottleneck that prevents computer scientists from going on to becoming ethical hackers is because of that exact motivation, right? People like to build things, and they don't necessarily, unless they're wired in a certain way, like many of our people are, they're not necessarily wired to want to go break something else, something that someone else built. So what would your advice be for how we can encourage more people who have that builder mindset, but would be equally good at this critically needed skill set that the world is in tremendously short supply of? How do we get more of them to come into security, given that it's about breaking, not building?
Yeah, I think that's a really cool question. And I think it's something that really, it's really intriguing. So I do agree that like students like to build things, but I think many people might not realize that breaking things is the same amount of a learning process as building something might be. So even though it's like tearing something down, that might seem a little bit counterintuitive, but I think when you break something, you really get to understand how the inner wiring works, how the thing is actually built. So in order to be able to, I guess, break something, you have to kind of know how to rebuild it. And I think the two really go hand in hand. So I really do think that students should kind of experience both, because, you know, both of them are fun in their own ways, and it's an equal learning experience on both sides.
Yeah, you know, actually all three of us were kind of in our cybersecurity club at school. And then I remember like to prepare for a competition, we'd have like red versus blue teams. So like the red team would try to hack the blue team and the blue team would try to secure against the red team. But like every time that happened, like we kind of found that the team that like was able to hack first, they would like kind of come out with an advantage over it. Cause like after hacking the system, they kind of know the ins and outs, like they know how to better like build it up to be better and like make it more secure. So I guess like just one way you can like kind of find more people to like break stuff down is just like also show them the benefits of it. And in fact, like, you know, thinking about a problem in like different ways, it also helps you understand it better, and you're able to like apply your knowledge later, because like you just have a deeper understanding of it.
And I'm curious on this same topic, I'm gonna run with it a little bit more. Just this idea that, I mean, it all can't be fun and games. We use the gamification as well. But
why not?
Learning, yeah. Oh, no, I guess it can be. That's kind of the point we want to make, right? But I guess what I'm trying to understand is that there are, let's figure out how to put this. So in English or in certain mathematics classes, there is an answer, right? If you don't use the punctuation correctly, you're doing it incorrectly. If you don't have the equation set up quite right, you're going to get the wrong result out of that equation. Yet when we're looking at coding and hacking and those two coming together, there isn't necessarily a right or wrong end result, right? There may be an unethical one or an illegal one or a result that we didn't want or expect when we built that thing or used it to do something it wasn't supposed to. My question is, how do you balance reading about what somebody else has figured out as possible, being presented to with, here are some things that your professor or you as teachers have figured out, and also coupling back in this idea that there's, it's really ultimately about the exploration of what is possible. So how do you merge those three together? Because for me, it's that third point that's really fun and interesting, but you kind of need the other two to see where things sit, where boundaries have been pushed, and then where maybe you can take them.
Right. So actually, like, the variability that comes with computer science is also what makes it really beautiful, because it adds like to the creative aspect of it. When we give our students the task of making a program, we don't tell them how to do it. So what's really interesting is that many of them come up with different ways of solving the problem. So that's really cool in the sense that they're just, you know, applying their creativity into programming. And then they realize that it's kind of like art in the sense like there's no right answer. And we really encourage that creative thinking, because then that further, you know, encourages them to, you know, realize that, hey, computer science is somewhere that I can really, you know, express myself in a creative aspect. So, yeah.
Yeah, and I think what we try to do when we're teaching these concepts and these, like, materials to the students, we like to call them kind of building blocks. So we'll like introduce them like a for loop. And we'll say, okay, now that you have this kind of basic building block, what can you do with this? What can you build on top? And with all these different types of building blocks, what kind of different creation or invention can you create, which will be your code? So like Sambi mentioned, we really like to make it so that they have an open mind. And after we do teach them these things, we kind of let them run with it on their own. So if they get to kind of explore what they would like to build and kind of see, I guess, the potential that the coding has. Because a lot of the times when these students are coming in, they haven't really experienced this before and they don't really know what code can do. And I think afterwards they get to kind of see, like you said, like pushing the boundaries, how much you can really go with this code and how far they could take their own building blocks and see what they can build. So I think the best thing I like about teaching these to students is kind of hearing the students after they have taken our class take further steps and implementations in order to kind of build off of what they learned and do even more and kind of explore the new boundaries that like and the new doors that we've kind of helped open for them. So I think one of my favorite feedback that I've ever received from a class was one student telling us that when she experienced Python and experienced like the different types of coding activities, it made her think of ways that she could improve her own code. So she said after the first class on the pseudocode and programming a calculator, she thought of ways to improve her own calculator. And after a bunch of research, she found out that the calculator could not only calculate like addition, subtraction, but also exponents and square roots. And she said that after it finally worked, she experienced like a ton of like gratification, like she felt really proud of herself. So I think that that's the best part of teaching people these kind of building blocks, is because they get to create their own thing and they get to discover it themselves and kind of continually explore it after we've laid down kind of the basics.
I want to jump on this because, and then Nicole, sorry, I'll let you go.
No worries.
But I want to comment on one thing that Ellen said, which is that you learn something and you don't have an answer, you have questions. And that's what really is about teaching. If you, I think this can answer Sean's question too. Like, you know, yeah, there is, for certain things, there is that right answer. But for the most part, when you teach a methodology. You don't teach this is the answer. You teach and go learn more. And so I think a teacher is successful if the people walk out of the class and they have more questions in their head than when they walked in. And so I wanted to add that because I feel like inspired by that thinking instead of the memorizing of things. So Nicole, sorry if I interrupted.
Oh yeah, no worries. But yeah, like, you know, my answer like kind of actually adds on to yours as well. I think like, as like, you know, just a group of people, I think everyone, like, you know, almost everyone, we're all like very goal oriented. Like, you know, we kind of have like an end goal in mind and we kind of like have this, you know, just, we have like, we kind of like imagine this kind of thing that we want to achieve. But then like, you know, as like we kind of go into higher education, those kind of goals, they'll be harder to achieve. And then it'll take a lot more time, a lot more research. And sometimes like maybe the way that we're doing it doesn't really work, or like, you know, we kind of start plateauing and, you know, it can be very discouraging. So I think like right now, like what we're trying to do with like art curriculum is also just like, you know, provide like different goals that they could all like kind of strive for. Like there isn't just one thing that they want, like for example, the calculator. You know, like the kind of goal that we give them is like addition, subtraction, like addition, division and multiplication. And then, but they're like, when like they're kind of thinking up their ideas, like, you know, even if it doesn't fit in like that kind of like structure, they can make their own calculator and like, you know, add square root or like exponents and do a lot of other things. So just like changing it up, making like them aware that there isn't just like one option they have to go for, is also a way to like keep them motivated, because it's like very discouraging and you really want to give up when like the way that you thought you wanted to do something like wouldn't work. But yeah.
I think that's one of the things that where school in a traditional sense actually really fails students is, and that's a provocative thing to say, but I talk about that in my book a little bit, how school teaches us to sort of echo what Sean was saying, that there's a right answer and there's a wrong answer, and mistakes, you are literally punished for making mistakes. But that's actually not the way that things work in the real world. You want to make mistakes, not because you want to fail, but because you want to learn and keep moving forward. And so fundamentally, mistakes are actually okay. What's not okay is when, and I'll use the word student generally, not just to mean someone who's in high school or college, but a student of life, when someone makes a mistake and doesn't learn from it, or keeps making the same mistake, or doesn't extract from it what's the lesson for how to get better. And in so many ways, that's what learning is about. And I don't think that the education system itself is broken, but what's ultimately happening is that students are being instructed that there is only one right way to do things. And in fact, as you guys have all correctly identified, that's very much not the case. I mean, the entire field of ethical hacking is saying literally the opposite. It's supposed to do this. Can it do this instead? And that's what we spend every waking moment of every day doing. I had this, I tell this story in my book about this guy that I know who had this vending machine in his high school. And like many high school students, he wanted to get a lot of candy, but he didn't have a lot of money. And so he wanted to understand how could he get a lot of candy with his limited money. And so what he started doing was looking at how could he abuse the way that the vending machine worked. And it turns out the vending machine, what it does, you put your bill in and it registers, is this a bill? What denomination is it? And then it lets you select your treat. But there's no mechanism to keep you from pulling it back out. And so he just needed to figure out, well, how do I do that? And so ultimately what he did was he was able to figure out how to attach a piece of dental floss to this dollar bill. He'd put the dollar bill in, he'd get his treat, and then he'd pull it right back out. And that is absolutely not the way the vending machine is supposed to work. I don't have to call a single vending machine company in the world, and I can tell you what they will say, which is that is not how it's supposed to work. But that's the way we should all be thinking. That's certainly what ethical hackers think like. And I think even computer science, people who are not on the ethical hacking side, but are on the building side, that's the way we should all be thinking too, right? Is here's the constraint, here's the goal, can it do something different?
I love that. That may be less than ethical, that particular scenario, but
yeah.
Well, but then
but the point is well taken.
If the vendor of the vending machine learned and made a more exactly. secure machine, then you contributed. Exactly. And you also got a lot of candy, so that's the payoff.
So what I want to touch on here is this idea, because at least when I'm thinking about my own little brain, I can only handle so much, right? I'm only able to solve a certain level of a problem. And then it's like this much, just a little teeny bit. And then I turn to Marco and say, here's the rest of it, go for it. And he solves the bigger part of it. No, but it's been, seriously though, a problem can get so complex and so wide and broad and deep that it can be almost impossible for a single person to come up with a solution. And that goes for building and breaking. You mentioned the red team and the blue team. There's strength in numbers, strength in brain power, multiple people coming together. So talk to us a little bit about curriculum that you're putting together, that teams are a critical element.
Yeah, so I think most of the learning actually does come from the team and when people are able to collaborate and kind of share thoughts and work through a problem together. So one of the things that we try to do is put people in small breakout rooms and small groups and say, okay, we have this one problem that we want to solve. We want you to build something or we want you to break something. And how can you guys each find different approaches to do it, but kind of combine all your thoughts and all the brain power to kind of work through this problem together? So I think that really positive reinforcement from a small group setting is really important. There is power in a team. And when you get to talk to people about your problem, you see different approaches or you find different ways of doing things that you wouldn't really have noticed before. So I think we really try to promote that collaboration. We try to make it more comfortable since, you know, we're high schoolers ourselves and we're trying to teach middle schoolers and we try to really make it like they're a team and they're trying to work through a problem. And coding can seem very individual sometimes because, you know, you usually like at your computer making some code, but it's a lot more than that. There's a lot of collaboration to be done and there's a lot of scenarios in the coding world and the computer science and hacking world where you would have to work with someone else. And by having that other perspective and by hearing what others have to say, you can go so much further than if you're just doing it alone. So I think it's something really important that we're really trying to promote is not only how do you know how to code, but how do you know how to work with others? How can you like listen and intake their feedback to help improve your own code and help create kind of a joint effort that creates something that you wouldn't have been able to create on your own?
I think like a really cool thing that I found is like as the class progressed, when like a student had questions, they didn't ask like me or like the other instructors, they kind of started asking each other, which was like just really cool because like they really did become a team. I mean, like in just four classes, like they were like exchanging like Roblox usernames and stuff, like they were actually becoming friends. But like, yeah, it was like really great how our platform was able to like bring people together, and then like have them work together and like, you know, like Ellen said, learn off of each other and like answer each other's questions.
Yeah, and we implement like that teamwork element in like our organization itself. Like starting this organization in San Diego would be like a daunting task for like one individual. So that's why we have a team and we help each other out and we really like balance each other's responsibilities so not one of us like ever feels overwhelmed.
And Devo unlocks the full value of machine data for the world's most instrumented enterprises. About, like, the Devo data analytics platform addresses the explosion in volume of machine data and the crushing demands of algorithms and automation. Learn more at devo.com. Bug Crowd's award-winning platform combines actionable contextual intelligence with the skill and experience of the world's most elite hackers to help leading organizations identify and fix vulnerabilities, protect customers, and make the digitally connected world a safer place. Learn more at bugcrowd.com.
The bad hackers, it's often perceived as this sort of lone actor.
If you enjoyed this podcast, share ITSP Magazine with your friends, family, and colleagues. If you represent a company and wish to associate your brand with our conversations, sponsor one or more of our columns.
Those issues,
thank you for listening.
Including the really important ones, like things that have never been seen before. That's done by teamwork. And you know, at our organization, one of the things that we're always looking to do is we rotate people across different teams. That enables not only fresh perspectives, but it takes the expertise that certain individuals have and it exposes others to it. So like one of our core values is all about education itself, which is why I love this particular topic. But it's all about people teaching each other and enhancing each other's skills and challenging each other's assumptions so that we can keep getting better. And it's really because of that teamwork that enables our success and enables really success of kind of any ethical hacking team. And it just always makes me think of when I was in high school myself and on the lacrosse team, one of my teammates, his mom would always scream from the sidelines. In the middle of the game, we'd have to stop and laugh because she's ridiculous. She'd just be like, "Teamwork makes the dream work." And it was like so nonsensical and it didn't make any sense in the context of what was happening in the game. But that stayed with me many, many years later. And I think that's really what we're talking about here, that teamwork does in fact make the dream work.
It does.
It certainly does. And I think there's another connection here that I'd like to make as we come to the close here. And that's, and I think everybody's touched on it, is we're constantly learning. And again, if we're on our own looking inward, we're not going to learn as much unless we're interacting with others and collaborating with others. So the world around us is changing. The world that we're building for ourselves is changing. The technology is changing. The threats are changing. It's all an ongoing fluid environment. And so the connection between teams and groups and collaboration and continuous learning as humans, I think, come together quite nicely. And we are humans around the world, right, Marco? And so on that point, what do we have coming up next?
If we were playing a team sport, I would say you gave me a really good pass to go for the kill, because I was actually thinking that I wanted to introduce the next episode, which is about talking about globalizing the community and Elevate the Future has chapter in different places in the world already and it's growing. So we definitely want to talk about that. And I was thinking, as Sean and Ted were talking about the teams, like, yeah, we are successful as a team, but the biggest team is the human team, you know, as a global solution to the big problem that we're facing right now. I think we're starting to realize that only if we all act together in the end, we're going to resolve this big problem. And of course, that's my, you know, me being philosophical and idealistic. But we can start from how you guys branch out to create similar chapter to what you do all over the world. And I know that Ellen, you are the global ambassador. So I guess I'll ask you. And then, of course, Nicole and Sanvi just jump in and introduce what the next episode is and a tiny bit of the globalization. And then we'll just say goodbye and we'll see everybody next time.
Yeah, so I'm super excited about the upcoming podcast as well. As you mentioned, it's going to be about globalization and community impact. And I think that's one of the most important parts of any organization or any effort or initiative, is that to really be able to bring in all these different people from all over the world and create that impact together as like a team, you know? So I think it's really important to be able to not only impact those around you or in your local community, but also strive further, you know, but be able to incorporate these cultures in different areas across the world and have them join in on the initiative as well, because there is power in the team. So yeah, I think for the next podcast, we're going to talk about how we bring in culture and like diversity and try to teach the underprivileged across the world and really try to bring in this initiative to something much further than we could have just on our own.
Yeah, exactly. And it's like, just, I think one thing that kind of like benefits from having like virtual classes is like we're able to reach more people. Like even in our organization, as we're marketing our classes, although a good number of our students are from like our local community in San Diego, we do have many students from like Northern California, other states, like even like a few from Canada. So it was like really cool to like see a lot of people in our classes show up as well. But like, yeah, like we're always trying to expand and like provide, like have our resources be able to like be accessible to other people, not just in our community.
I don't know. For me, sometimes it's fun to do stuff for the sake of doing something, just because it is possible, perhaps, and seeing if it is possible. But when you can attach a purpose to it, it has so much more meaning, right? And I think the conversation we're going to have next about the community impact and the diversity and bringing multiple people together from all over the world to tackle a bigger problem outside of San Diego, I think it's going to be a really cool conversation. So I'm really looking forward to that one. And so with that, I think we'll wrap this. We'll hopefully everybody learned a little something who listened. I certainly did. and clearly I want to thank Ellen, Nicole, and Sanvi for joining us for this conversation, one of many we're going to be having. And by all means, Ted, always a pleasure, my friend, and really appreciate you joining us for this one.
Yep, love being here. Thank you guys so much for having me.
Thank you all.
Thank you.
Thank you for having me.